Om Sahanabhavatu, Sahanabhunaktu, Sahavīryam karavāvahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu mā vidviṣāvahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
What is that doing? Do we have the books for tomorrow?
It's
we have them here? Okay, great. Thank you. So then tomorrow morning we'll have class. Okay. Let's see what we can do with these. Not belonging. I have had a feeling of not belonging the whole of my life. I have come to see that this is quite usual, and quite a usual feeling around people. I think you mean to say here, I've come to see that this is quite a normal feeling that many, many people have in this era that's untaken. Why is that? Well, you know, psychologically we say it's because we didn't get filled up enough when we were young. It's basically what it is. And another thing, to give just a little more than that, is that Kohut has said that mirroring is the oxygen for the soul. That's how important it is. Everybody know what mirroring is? It's like, if I'm looking at you, you're looking back at me in a way there's kind of a dance going, unconscious dance in facial features and expression and eye contact. There's a rapport that's happening just in the body language. And in fact, that's natural. It's not like you're trying to have that rapport. It just automatically is taking place. And then when it doesn't take place, that's really disconcerting. You know, I told a terrible story about the experiments they did in the 50s or so, where the mother would just not mirror her baby, and the baby would do everything that they could think of to try to get that. And when the mother continued to not do it, the baby's decompensated. So there's no, you don't know what's going on. You know, it's very strange. And usually you never think about it because it's always happening. Then when you run into something or there's some kind of contact with someone and there's no mirroring taking place, you feel really discombobulated in a way, just kind of very uncomfortable and don't quite know what to do. So it's time to make a quick retreat, is what I say. It's not comfy at all. And so this, what's exactly the language used? We've talked about this before, so I'll just kind of go around it again. Not that we don't go around things many, many times. I think not feeling of not belonging is just feeling of not being loved, not belonging, not being wanted, not being loved. It all comes down to feeling loved, you know. And the feeling of being loved is, unless it's just going to be a palliative, like a band-aid or something, it's something that's already there structurally in your unconscious, in the psychic structure itself, because of the amount of love and attention you were able to get as a child. One of the problems in our era is both people are working, two people have to work, at least in the States, in order to have enough money, you know, to have a house or to have anything really. It's not a one-person income anymore, for sure. And if you are kind of in the middle class or lower middle class or below, there's really not enough money. And so everybody's highly stressed. And so very often, the kids just don't send, they simply don't get what they need to be enough. It's always just good enough. Always remember that, like, good enough mother, that's a Winnicott. It has to be good enough. And if it's not good enough, then structurally there's a hole inside. It's very hard to fill. You get it filled by someone or some situation, and they're giving you enough attention for that time, then you feel really fine. But as soon as the person goes away, then the hole is there. Whereas if you've had good enough parenting, then you're not very dependent on other people to make you feel loved. You like to fall in love and you like to be liked and all of that. But you don't feel that you don't walk around feeling unloved or unwanted, you know, or that you don't belong. You just kind of imagine you would never feel that you don't belong if people want you to be with them, you know. Though I did feel that once. This was kind of interesting. I was with a group of friends. I was around 20 or so. And we'd gone to Arizona, and these people were all artists, and they were all very committed to theater. And I did a lot of theater, too, when I was in college and in high school. And I also got involved with the people in the art scene, and these were potters who were building big pottery homes. Very neat. And there was an artist doing that, and so we all went there. And all these people were totally into what they were doing. They were either the artists doing their work, totally committed to it. The people in theater, who are a lot of good friends of mine, were totally committed to it. And I was just kind of pretending, because I really wasn't. And it wasn't my thing. I knew that. You know, so I really, even though I liked all of the people and we were kind of a group, you know, group of friends, I still, I felt like an imposter in the group. And I didn't want to be an imposter in the group. I just was, because it wasn't my thing, you know. And so in that way, I felt that I not only felt, I knew I didn't belong. And then the problem was, where do I belong? I had no idea. And I felt also that I had something to give, you know. Something, some destiny, something. But I had no idea what it was. And it was really disconcerting. It lasted for a couple of years, I think. So there can be that kind. I didn't think of that. I was thinking more about just the psychological, I don't belong anywhere because I don't feel wanted. But there's that other kind of belonging that can be really painful for young people, like in their teens and 20s when they really don't know what they're going to do with their life, and they're kind of hoping that something comes along that gives them a sense of purpose and meaning. And there can be a long haul for some people, young people, like, what am I going to do? What do I want to do? Even why am I here? It'd be very, very disconcerting. And I think for most young people, once in a while somebody knows what they're going to do when they're even 8 or 9 years old, or in high school, they know, they're very clear. But most young people aren't. And they're hoping, praying, that they will kind of find out what they want to do. So there's that level also. I think young people, like up to maybe 25, 28 or something like that, it's really stressful, you know. You don't know what you're going to do with your life. And yet, you should be doing something. You should want to be doing something, but you may not know what it is. So, ugh, it's hard. But the other kind is that just not feeling loved, and I think because of not getting filled up when you're young. And then I think inner child work is good for that. Having a dog or cat is good, because they will definitely love you devotedly at all times. And that gives such a nice feeling, you know, to have animals around you. It gives such a wonderful feeling, just their presence. You know, it's kind of across the board. Like, we found that by giving, you know, in old folks' homes where they're kind of put away, if we bring animals, like a dog or so, or even cats. It makes all of the difference. It's all of a sudden love comes into the, you know, into the rest home. Makes a huge difference, you know. Also bringing dogs mostly into hospitals, especially for young kids. It makes a huge difference. They've even found that for now, this is not, I would say it's not, it's still uncommon, but it's common enough to be known about, is that now in hospitals, they let the patient's dog come into the hospital and even crawl and sleep on the bed. I think that's absolutely wonderful. It's so curative, you know. And so animals are the huge blessing. So many people know about it. We should protect them, you know. Anyway, they're really sacred. Having children, you don't want to have children just so that they can fill you up. That's a problem. fill me. But, so that is an issue. On the other hand, just with, if you're in the normal range of, you know, not having that level of confidence in them, but not in the pathological range. It's just kind of the, what we call garden variety neurotics, which is all of us. That's our title. So for, with that, then I think children are such a beautiful thing, because as hard and stressful as it is, there is so much love and so much giving involved, so much giving, that if it's in your, if it's in your prarabdha to have children, I think that's a great thing. You know, some people maybe think it's not spiritual. I think it's one of the most spiritual sadhanas you can possibly imagine, because your heart does become so big. You can handle so much. You become so strong. Everything's about taking care of someone else. You're way in the background. The little one is completely in the foreground, you know, and so the amount of love that's involved in that, and giving, and also pushing yourself behind, beyond extreme tiredness and all of these things, it makes, it's very beautiful, you know, it's Bhagawan. It's all Bhagawan's, you know, infinite intelligence. So it brings a lot about, just naturally, a lot of maturity, you know. So those of us who don't have children, we find other ways in our own prarabdha. You find other things that create and cause you to stretch. But with a child, it's stretches you to the maximum. Stretches in your love expands infinitely. So if you happen to be a Vedanta and you have children, I think that's really, really good. We don't have to worry about your antakarana shuddhi. The little ones will take care of all that. That's what I think. Yeah. Starting to overheat. There. Okay. Yeah. So.
Could I ask a question about this type of not belonging through the mid-20s? Because I have cousins and lots of friends who are in that phase. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we can say, or anything other than, you know, you'll find your way?
That's basically what I say. Yeah. I said, I'll always share what I went through and what all my friends went through, and that it's part of it. It's not easy, but you do find your way. You know, it takes time. Yeah, and sometimes it seems like it's taking way too long, you know. But it all works out in the end. I think it's just a hard time for young people.
So it just is hard.
Well, I wouldn't know how to make it easy. I still don't know how to make that easy, because you probably don't have Vedanta at that time, so you don't have any inner sanctuary, and you're just vulnerable, you know, trying to think what's going to happen to me. What am I going to do, you know? And how am I going to make money? It's really hard in the States right now because of the last 5 or 6 years, 7 years, and we had Bush in the office. We just about went bankrupt. And then all the whole generation of young people, all graduating from college or not, there were basically no jobs for them because all of the people who had good jobs lost their jobs. You know, people who had big, big jobs, corporate jobs, and were making a lot of money in technology and everywhere, they had to go get all these low-level jobs. And so the young people had no jobs, you know. All the older people who were trying to support their families were doing everything, flipping burgers, you know, anything to get a job. And that went on for several years. So that we have a whole generation of young people who, you know, thousands of them had no work at all. So that would be really stressful, especially if you spent $200,000 for a degree in student loans and get out and there's no job for you at all. And there's a waiting list of all of these professionals who have lost their jobs. So it's work coming out of that now. I don't know what we'll be going into. So thing now. Now we're really having interesting times. What's that? A Chinese proverb or something? I think it says, never be born in interesting times. You'd think that they'd say the opposite, but no. I'll have to look that up. Is there levels of clarity in terms of Viveka, or is it either I see or I don't? No, there's a lot of different levels in growth. It's just that you come to Vedanta as a mumukshu with all good enough in each one, just good enough that allows that mumukshutvam. It could be very extreme, but for most of it's good enough, and all the shama dhamma, the mumukshutvam, all of it, vairagya, it's all good enough. And then it, as the teacher teaches it, also like viveka, you'll have some idea, maybe, that all of this is time bound. There's no way I can find anything here that will be lasting. You can see that much, but when the teacher gets a hold of you, then this viveka and vairagya is really dilated, you know, until you really understand each one of these values much more than you could have possibly understood when you first came. And so that also increases your state of viveka, vairagya, etc. Because of understanding what they are and understanding the problem. So the teacher does a lot in the beginning to create the mumukshutvam, because there's a good enough mumukshutvam, you know, to bring the student, but then the teacher will really expand on those, that sadhana chatushtaya, and change the mumukshutvam into what we call jignyasa, the desire to know. The desire to be free has to be converted into the desire to know, because the knowledge of the self, the knowledge of Brahman, is moksha, you know. And so say you want to be free, and how can I get free? Well, Swamiji will joke and say, well, stand on your head, eat brown rice and sprouts. Eat lots of sprouts. He does that for me because I was macrobiotic at one time. I never heard the end of it. Stand on your head and eat sprouts. You go on and on. You know, but we want to be free. You don't even know what that means. How to be free? What does it mean if you're free? You know, what does it mean to be whole and to complete and happy? How do you even go about doing that? But I know that it's there because I've had glimpses, and I know that there's something. I know there's something because we've all had glimpses of it. How to get that? You know, not just little glimpses. How to really know? So that has to happen. So then all of these, what we call the sadhana chatushtaya, these fourfold sadhanas, viveka, vairagya, then the shamadhi shatka, this group of six, beginning with shama, Shana Dhamma Upadhyaya Tiksha Shraddha Samadhanam. That's a group of six. And Mumukshutvam. We have to know all these by heart. Okay. So all of these will mature, really resolve into your knowledge. For instance, with the viveka, the definition of viveka is nitya nitya vastu viveka. Nitya anitya vastu viveka. That means the discrimination between that which is, the vastu is any type of thing or subject matter, that which is time bound, nitya, and time bound, anitya, timeless, nitya. So when you come, you only realize that everything's time bound. You'd have no idea what it would even mean for something to be free of time, right? So vairagya, that dispassion resolves into, instead of the sour grapes, this is, well, it's not really sour grapes, but this is not going to be able to give me what I'm really seeking. It can't do it. Just because of the nature, it's nature, it can't do that. It's subject to change. Everything about me is subject to change. How can I possibly have anything but temporary fullness, a temporary state of fullness, which is a good definition of samsara? How do you get out of that? And so that vairagya comes from those recognizing those limitations. The vairagya becomes complete when you've discovered that your own being is the ananda that you've always sought in the world. And then you have vairagya, not because, oh, this isn't going to do it for me type of vairagya, into a more positive, I have what I need already, I don't need anything else. It's called the alam buddhi. The alam buddhi is that conviction, here buddhi, you take as conviction, is alam, it's enough. So we have the alam buddhi for sleep, for food, and for sex. These three things are in the shastra. That can give you these three things, can give you the alam buddhi. But it's only a temporary alam buddhi. Like you can only sleep for so long. And let's sleep just a little bit more. Oh no, I can't sleep one more minute. You have to get up. Food. You eat and eat, and then you're full, and you just have to say, no, I can't have any more. As delicious as it was, you can't do it. That's an alam buddhi. But what about when the alam buddhi is just the constant? Because what you used to think you needed from the universe, you are. You already have that. So that alam buddhi is a way of defining a jnani, somebody who has self-knowledge. So alam means enough, and buddhi here means conviction, that alam buddhi, your mind has that natural feeling of it's fine, everything is good, it's enough. Another definition is called kritya krityaha. That's a kritya means that which, it's a potential participle, kritya, that which needs to be done, that which has to be done, that which is to be done. Kritya has been done. Kritya kritya. That person's a kritya kritya. They have done, they've accomplished what is to be accomplished. It's over. It's not something more you need to do. Like when we accomplish something in samsara in the world, you accomplish it, it's a big deal, you're so happy you've got it, and then, oh, give it 15 seconds later, you get this thought, okay, but I also need this, or some equally disturbing thought. That's how it is, very shocking. Especially if it was a big accomplishment. You're just basking in it, whatever. And then everything starts creeping up. You know? I also need this, and somebody could take this away. And then the whole samsara comes back. It doesn't give you much time before. It can last for a while, and those little things aren't that big, but they're big enough to put salt on the wound a little bit, you know. Is it true that one's life, mitya, experiences are 50% sukha and 50% dukkha? Well, I don't know if it's exactly that, but it's kind of how they talk about it in the shastra. And they talk about, when they say that 50-50, they're talking about this bhuloka, where you can attain, you can gain moksha. You have free will in this loka. You have a buddhi, you know, and so you, that mumukshutvam is possible for you, and that, and gaining moksha is possible in this particular loka. And so having free will, you also accrue karma, punya and papa, in this loka. Having, gaining this loka where you have a human body is considered tremendous punya, to have a physical body, and then even more punya is to have some sort of a useful buddhi, you know, not, you don't have to be brilliant, it just has to be useful, you know. And then to have some mumukshutvam, you can have, that's considered huge amount of punya, so it goes on like that, just praising this particular loka. Because you have free will, you can make choices. So one way for us is for this upayanishta, for gaining the antakarana shuddhi, or just facilitating that growth of, or development of antakarana shuddhi, understanding the prarabdha karma as Ishwara and being present to the unfoldment of your life. So there's no real free will there. You don't need to use your free will. That Bhagavan is unfolding your life, which includes your body, mind, sense organs, and your situation. So you're part of that unfoldment that upadis are. Maybe where your participation in all of that is how you respond to your life. That's where you have the most free will. And the ability to choose dharma over adharma. To choose dharma, so dharma, when there's dharma, adharma is your choice, really. What gets in the way of that is the self-ignorance that causes raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes. Those can conflict with dharma because you really want it really badly, you know. And so if in this Viveka Chudamani, in the first few verses, they're actually talking about the punya for actually having that mumukshutvam, and crores of punya, they'll say, in order to get such a body. Well, that crores and crores of punya is crores and crores of lifetimes, and lifetimes of dharma, you know, where your highest conviction is dharma, and it's much stronger than your raga dvesha. And so when that's your likes and dislikes, and so when that's the case, the likes and dislikes are there, the uncomfortable situations are there, everything is there, but your choice is always dharma. Ahimsa, top. Ahimsa, kindness, I put ahimsa, kindness. Golden rule, do unto others as you would want done to yourself, very good to meditate on. And don't do to others as you don't want done to yourself. And then after that, it's all those particular things that all have those things at the top. And these are all then just specific, particular situations that sometimes you have to think about. It's not always obvious. But that's where the commitment is. And when the commitment is there, then your upadhi is really just in harmony with Ishwara, because Ishwara is an expression of dharma. But there's nothing. Ishwara is, if you say his scaffolding, or all of his bones are dharma. All of the laws are dharma. And so to the degree that that's primary for you, you have a lot of sense of belonging. That's a good place to start. You have a real sense of belonging and being and shanti inside, and being well connected with God, whoever God is for you. It doesn't really matter. Because God is really, the God, what we call Bhagavan, is really, really recognized or experienced in the Shanti, you know. You have to have some knowledge to experience Bhagavan in the Ashanti, you know, in pain. You know, a religious person, a dharmic, does do that, you know. So, the 50-50... For this bhumi, it's a learning, this loka, it's a learning loka, you know. And and they do say it's like 50-50, but I don't think that they mean that you have to get the scales out. It's approximately 50-50. And you can look at the negative experiences that come your way as your sadhana. That's how we're doing the for us in the terms of antakarana shuddhi. Those are our moments of sadhana because they're not easy, you know. And so you have to grow to be able to accommodate that, to be able to have those difficult things take place in your mind, which still has what we call this Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. My life is a worship of Ishwara. Arpana means like doing puja, a worship. And I accept everything that comes my way with that prasada buddhi. That's what we call karma yoga. And that understanding or that practice or commitment is something that is meant for a mumukshu, somebody who's being exposed to this knowledge and starting out being exposed to this knowledge, because those attitudes take the mind to just like within a hair's breadth of a jnani's mind. Krishna himself says this in the Gita. Because everything is Ishwara, everything that comes your way is prasada, and everything way you behave is as an arpana, as a puja. And so with that attitude, you're learning about Ishwara. You also see yourself as part and parcel of Ishwara. The only difference between a mumukshu and a jnani is that for the mumukshu, everything you see more and more as the unfoldments continue. Everything is Ishwara. Your body, mind, senses, organs are Ishwara. You're Ishwara too. But that kartritvam is still there, that sense of doership. Whereas in the end, as this knowledge really matures, everything is Ishwara. This body, mind, sense organs is Ishwara. The self is Ishwara. The ahankara, which is mitya at this point, is Ishwara. There's absolutely nothing that's not Ishwara. And so you are just you yourself, that you used to have, you have devotion to Ishwara, and Ishwara is different from you. Now we can still have that devotion and have that ishta devata, but all of it's mitya, including this body, mind, sense organs, and mind, and everything is mitya. But that everything is what we call Ishwara, and everything about me, the body, mind, sense organs, is included in this creation and belongs to it, belongs to Ishwara. And then the adhishtana of the whole thing is my being, which is Ishwara's being. So where am I in all of that? Well, I am Ishwara, that's where. I am Ishwara because there's nobody else here. This me that I am, this is Ishwara, this is Brahman. The me that I am is Brahman, the very self of Ishwara, and this body, mind, sense organs is a part and parcel of Ishwara. So there is really only Ishwara. And so now, as we really start to understand that, you can kind of start experimenting, relaxing into your prarabdha karma, experiment with being more present, staying more in the present, and seeing how Bhagavan handles this situation that's going to be coming up, you know. Have more patience, more interest. It's more exciting to see. Because if you really start analyzing this, every single thing you do involves maybe thousands upon thousands of cause-effect things coming together to let anything happen, you know? And so as you start to really understand the tremendous complexity of this whole universe, which includes all of your upadis, everything about you it includes, and from the standpoint of the self that is me is Brahman, is Ishwara. So there's no isolation, and there's kind of a relaxation into this creation and being happy with what comes my way. Yadrichaya, it's called. For a sannyasi, is one yadrichaya, whatever comes my way, that's fine. Why would that be fine? Because it's like animal crackers. Remember the animal crackers? It's all like everything's like animal crackers. It's all the same stuff. You know? And so I can be happy with whatever it is. You know, you have to grow into that, and you know, we have, you know, infinite lives behind us. We have a lot of samskaras, all of them based in ajnanam. So it takes some time for that total shift to take place. It takes place with your knowledge, shravana, continued shravana, manana, nididhyasana, continual understanding, more and more antakarana shuddhi, you know, more and more enjoying having your life be about others, not about yourself. It makes a huge difference, but it takes some time. We don't make these big changes don't come overnight. But it's a very pleasant ride. It's a very pleasant maturing process, I'd say, after the first couple of years. Because the first couple of years for most of us, the first 2 or 3 years, there's a lot of stuff coming up, and you don't know quite enough yet. There's not quite enough. I don't have quite enough strength, but all of the stuff that's coming up and having to be dealt with. And then it becomes, so things settle down, and then you enjoy the process of that rose maturing. You have to be very gratefully patient, you know. I love the attitude of how a parent, or any one of us actually, are with a little baby, you know, who's growing up, like this first 3, 4, 5 years, you know, especially those beginning years when they're just learning all of these things and amazing, you know, and you just have so much love and so much patience as they learn all these little things, big things, you know, like the first time they stand up and even holding on to something. This is so exciting, you know. And there's only love there. There's not, she's not walking quickly enough. It doesn't come. Patience and love. And I think that that's the right attitude to have toward this maturing process, maturing into a mind that this is not in competition with the ananda of your nature. You know? We should be very patient because we've had like beginningless births, and now we want to get the A. How long is this going to take anyway? We should be very patient and enjoy the process, enjoy becoming a bigger person, and not having so many pains and hurts inside or so many reactions inside. It's very, very nice. Because you know too, you, as you mature, you know that you're maturing. You're getting the fruits of it. And you also become more patient with the areas that are not, still need some time. You should always just think of a little child, how patient you are. We're like little children in reference to this process of growth around our knowledge. So. Oops. Let's see. Gotcha. Can you please share a little bit about how you teach or introduce your clients in therapy to inner child, inner friend work? Do you involve meditation? Do you involve meditation as a practice, or not? Or do you get them to start the process of invoking, or how? Oh, I see. Or how do you get them to start the process of invoking that inner dialogue? I don't have any special with my clients. I don't have a special way of introducing it. I just wait for an opening. You wait for the opening to come, and then you make use of that opening, and then it feels very, very natural. And I'm not in a hurry, but it usually doesn't take too long, like maybe within the first, it could be in the very, very first few months or less, depending on the client. And also, not everybody is ready for that at all. It doesn't even work. They don't have that, they don't have what we call that inner space inside yet. And so then they don't have any idea how to do that. But for most people, It's pretty natural. So you just, you have to wait, because when you first meet a client, you have to get to know them, who they are, and what they're doing, and what's going on with them. And there will be an opening for the inner friend and for doing inner child work. And I had one client for about 14 or 15 years, up until when I retired. And and she could, it never, that inner child never worked for her. We had to do other things. Yeah. What she loved to do was dream work. She'd always come in with her dreams, and that's where we had a lot of, you know, where you're just really two psyches together in around this dream. And we would get a lot of things that happened through dream work, which is very Jungian. But for whatever reason, the inner child, the inner friend, and even the inner friend, inner child, all of this, she couldn't make it work. We would laugh about it, you know, 10 or 12 years into it. We said, well, what about the inner child work? And we would laugh, because this wasn't happening that way, but there was that was good. Anyway, everybody's different. So,
what about then? Because I'm thinking, it wasn't my question, but now it came up questions about that. Because I know some people thinking about, and I myself also thinking about, what if you want to invite people to do that? I mean, like in a group or something, and guide it. Let's say in a yoga studio or something. Mm-hmm. Because I've also thought about that it's very, very deep.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't know the people who come. I mean, it can also bring up stuff that they don't know how to handle. That's what I'm thinking of.
You know what you can do first, and then once you get to really know people on an individual basis. You know, though, in my classes at CIS, I teach all of that, like in the non-dual perspectives in spiritual counseling. I teach all of that, you know. But we've already gotten to know each other. We have kind of a safe container. There's usually about 11 or 12 people in the class, and I will bring it up as some, because they're learning how to be therapists also. And so they've probably had experience with it, but if you have kind of a safe container and you bring that up, it tends to, I've not really had problems with it. Because it depends on the group. But one thing you can do without, I've never had a problem, is invoking that inner friend. Mm. The only problem with that sometimes is, and that I've made this mistake before, is you can feel, a student can feel, but I look for the inner friend and I can't find an inner friend inside. But that means that we've explained it wrongly. Because it's not about finding an inner friend inside, it's about recognizing that part of yourself when you are an inner friend. I mean, you are a friend to a friend, or to your child, or to your dog, or at work. You've been, say you're a therapist, then you really give a lot of love, a lot of friendship to your clients, which is natural too. It's not a funny thing that therapeutic relationship brings that. And so you've experienced, everyone has experienced themselves as a friend. But that turning it inward, you know, toward yourself, I don't mean Brahman, but yourself, your mind, and, you know, maybe some mistakes you've made, or where normally there would be a critical voice that you may have interjected from when you were young, a critical or a voice that is disrespectful of you. Instead, you can replace that with an inner friend, somebody who's on your side that loves you and only wants to help, and like Swamiji. Bring in somebody like that, or a really good mother, a father, you know, where you feel that there's not somebody inside that's going to criticize you or disrespect you. There's only someone who really wants to help you and will support you and, you know, be there for you. Then you have like there's a lot of shanti in your inner space just by that. It's such a powerful thing to find that part of yourself that has been a friend to others. Imagine that, get in touch with that part, and then turn it toward yourself. Thread your mind into the little ones inside. And that's, boy, it really changes the whole inner ambiance, you know, from a stress. How would it be to live with this critical voice all the time? You don't have a nice space to be. You don't have a place to live. You have to live with this monstrous critic, you know, or somebody who just doesn't think you're worth anything, or whatever tragic situations we've grown up with, you know. But you can make such a huge difference. Almost immediately, actually. It doesn't take a long time to do that. So I think that's a huge gift to give. Give that gift to anybody. It changes the whole life. It totally changed my life. It took in one day, in one sentence where I understood, you know, and I went back to my room and I did that. And I've done that ever since because it's such a huge thing. You know, it wouldn't be so huge if you already have that, you know, if you already have that in your space. But if you don't, then you get it, and it makes all the difference.
So maybe not then have like a single event, I mean, and go too deep in these kinds of meditations. Instead, maybe have a course or something.
Yeah,
to develop it gradually.
That would be like wonderful to do a course in meditation where you bring in all of these things, which it, in a sense is not really meditation, but what it is is mm-hmm. kind of the precursors to giving the mind the support that it needs in order to have a deep shanti, you know, naturally, and that shanti will keep growing, you know. So what we want is the mind to naturally be meditative. And so that inner friend helps with that. Understanding, like Swamiji's book, Value of the Values. Understanding Dharma and its relationship to your own well-being. All of these things help for having a mind that is just naturally abiding. And then, so that's kind of foundational. And then on top of that I would put yoga, pranayama, diet, these kind of things are so helpful to having a healthy upadhi, you know, and to having a deep space, inner space. But if, say, you have diet and yoga and pranayama and you don't have dharma, you know, then it helps when you're doing it. It just clears away the stuff for a little while, but then as soon as it wears off, there you are again. And so you need this foundational, I'm not talking about knowledge, and knowledge would go, you know, as being really foundational, and dharma and inner friend and all of these things are what give an inner child work. They give a lot of depth and peace to the to the mind, and then on top of that, the yoga and pranayama, having a good diet, gives a tremendous depth to that mind that already has some opening. Otherwise, the yoga and pranayama is very, very helpful for an enclosed experience, you know, and it can wipe out a lot of things for however long it lasts. So say you do a half an hour, an hour of yoga, and then do some of the pranayamas that like Emma and Jesper have taught me. This would blow your mind out of that. You can just sit like that. But that wears off. It's very nice. It's very nice for meditation. But you want a mind that is clear and happy, you know, and peaceful. And then you can do these type of things that give you some deep, deep absorption when you're doing Nididhyasana, which is very beautiful. Yeah. thought you were going to say something. I heard that. I think our time's up. Let me just look at this question. Can we reimagine really good friends when we were children in school in the same way as we imagine how we would have liked that our parents acted? Yeah, you, why not? It won't hurt anything to do that, you know. When we use imagining like people that we used to know, like kids or your brothers and sisters, you have to be respectful in your imagination as you are to people out here. That's all, you know. Like I said, I imagine my friends, they don't want to put horns on their head or something. If you're going to put horns on their head, then make up the character. But if it's something that, like a prayer, like say you, like I know for myself, I had two best friends that I went from kindergarten all the way till we were 18. All the way through as kind of a little group of us, you know. So say if you wanted to go back into something that happened with your group of friends or something, and then maybe there was some stress or whatnot and it still hurts you in some way, you could reimagine it in a way that's a blessing for all of them. You know, that's how we pray anyway. So even if, like if you go back, I'll talk about more negative things later, not now, because we don't have time. But say you go back into a childhood event that was very hurtful for you, you know, and you reimagine it in the way that you would have loved it to be. And you do it prayerfully, because that is what, or I've told you this, I think, a few times, that's how Swamiji prays. And at that time I asked him, how do you pray, you know? He imagines, he sees, if somebody comes, a child's very sick, he sees that. He just brings forward that imagination, you know. And if that imagination comes forward, just because I think of his level of intuition, I don't know what to say about it, but he feels very confident that child will be okay. And then and I said, well, what if you don't get that? And then I said, we will work on it. And he does. He will work on it and see, you know. Well, I'm saying this again just to understand that this, your imagination and your good wishes is a prayer. So you don't want it to be a curse. You want it to be a prayer. So you had a terrible thing happen with your parents or whatnot, and you reimagine it, try to reimagine it. That's a prayer that blesses everybody. There's something else maybe at Satsang that I can talk about, but what about when there's huge amounts of rage and hatred? Then what do? So that is there too.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.
We give these out now. Do you want them now? It'd be nice to look them over maybe and see how this works. What do you want to do tonight? I mean, we had bhajans last night, but what are you thinking about tonight? These are some more confused. Can you help me?
Yeah.
What should we do? We could have, you want the night off?
No.
Okay. Then why don't we answer what questions are here and do some song questions also? Would it be all right with you?
Yes.
Monica? Are you coming tonight?
Sure.
Okay. That's all right. We'll be able to do it without you. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, these are they're just turned around, I think.
Oh, I see.
It's only one.
Yeah, but this has the English translation.
Yeah.
So take one, and then take this other one. And then we'll leave the rest of them here. In case somebody isn't here tonight, we need to give them. Okay, so we'll have satsang tonight and then we'll sing some bhajans also. Is that okay with everybody?
Ooh, whoa, whoa, whoa.